Welcome to Chasing American History. I'm David Cross, and I am delighted to be back here speaking to you. We've taken a little time off for the summer, but now it is September, and we are ready to get back with our weekly podcast where we discuss different events of American history, primarily about the American Revolution right now. That's what we're going to spend most of our time during the next year, but we may step out, we may talk about some different things as current events dictate. Today is a warm day in Philadelphia in September. We'd had a few cool days, but summer's having its kind of last gasp here, I guess. I know I'm going to be giving a number of tours, but when you get to this type of the year, you're able to meet with the people who are holding back and waiting for the weather to get a little better and waiting for the crowds to get a little better. So I meet with more empty nesters and people who have retired and people who can plan their trips whenever they want to. They are not trapped by the dictates of their children, as I am and as many people are. And so it's a nice time of the year for me to be able to do tours and get to know people and be able to do more leisurely tours than sometimes we have in the summer. For those of you interested in the George Washington series we have been doing, I promise you we will get back to it, but we're going to take a little foray into another area for a few weeks, and I ask you to have a little patience, and I think you will find that what we're talking about is very interesting, and I promise you we will get back to George Washington. And let me say this, for those of you who are truly interested in George Washington, we would love you to join us for one of our George Washington tours. This is an 8-day tour that allows you to really get to know George Washington. And I think that George Washington is a character who doesn't get enough attention. I mean, some people may say, well, that's crazy. Everybody's heard of George Washington. We've all heard of him, but we don't know him. We feel like we know Benjamin Franklin. We know John Adams. We know Thomas Jefferson. But George Washington has become somewhat inscrutable and in many ways somewhat misunderstood. The picture we have of him on the dollar bill is not really a fair one. He makes us think of a tetchy, grumpy old man. And so I love to take people on a George Washington tour so that people can really get to know him. Because if you look at our history, there's one person who, if you take him out of the story, all of our history might be different. And that's George Washington. If you take him out of the story, we might not win the Revolutionary War. And if we win the Revolutionary War, we might not have a Constitution. And if we have a Constitution, it's going to look very different from the Constitution that we have. And if we have a presidential office, of course, that's going to be very different. It's staggering when you think about it, the effect that this one man had. And I know there's many people who say, no, that's false history. One man doesn't make a huge difference. One person doesn't make a huge difference. It's forces of people, it's economic forces, it's the masses. And while certainly there's some truth to that, it's also true that every now and then you do have one person who makes a big difference. And I would argue that George Washington is one of those people. So I invite you to take one of our trips with us. We would love to see you. The trip begins in Pittsburgh, and that's where we're going to see young George Washington. We're going to go out and see Fort Necessity, the fort that he created that is maybe the worst fort I've ever seen for military purposes, but hey, you gotta learn somewhere, right? So we're going to see that, and we're going to talk about George Washington. You're picked up from the airport, taken to the nearby hotel that we meet at, and we're going to talk on the night before the tour actually begins. Then, as I say, we're going to go see Fort Necessity. We're going to see where George... Oh, there's my dog back there. He's getting angry about this. We're going to see where George Washington first made his mark on events. And we're going to go back along the same trail that George Washington took after his unsuccessful battle at the side of General Braddock, who was killed during the battle. So we're going to talk all about young George Washington. And the second part of our journey is going to be in Philadelphia. There's a lot to see in Philadelphia pertaining to George Washington. If George Washington, the man, was born in Virginia, then George Washington, the statesman, was born in Philadelphia, because this is where he comes to participate in the First Continental Congress. People don't pay much attention to him at that Congress because nobody's talking about military action yet. But when he returns for the Second Continental Congress, it's a whole different thing. And he returns, and nobody fails to notice this, in his military uniform. It's as if he's telling everybody, okay, I'm here and I'm ready to go. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the other events that were happening in Philadelphia that so affected George Washington, the writing of the Declaration of Independence. We'll go see the actual place where that happened. Of course, the State House where George Washington and others debated American independence. Now, the State House is also the place where you have the Constitutional Convention. So another place where George Washington absolutely shines and where he proves to be absolutely indispensable. Many scholars will say that there never could have been a Constitution without George Washington, and I know a lot of his contemporaries felt that way. It's a big reason why he agreed to come. He was told, you know, if you don't come, it's not going to happen. There's too much distrust. There's too many people who think we're going to try to create a monarchy, and George Washington was the one person they trusted, because if he'd wanted to do that, he would have done that already. So we'll see a number of places. We'll see where George Washington lived, his house called the President's House. We'll see where he ate and drank over at City Tavern. We'll see a number of places that had importance in George Washington's life. And after that day, we're going to look at George Washington, the soldier. We're going to start with Washington Crossing and the Battle of Trenton. This is an amazing story, and we discuss this in depth. You know, most people who come out to Washington Crossing, they look at the bridge that approximates where George Washington crossed the Delaware, and they walk around, and that's kind of it. It's not the easiest terrain to explain the story. In other words, it's not like Gettysburg. It's not all set aside and turned into a national park. My good friend and associate Wilson Dorwood has done a fantastic job creating the best tour in America of Washington Crossing. We see it all out there. We see where Washington crossed the Delaware. We see the houses where the generals were staying before crossing the Delaware, before the Battle of Trenton. We're going to see the actual church where Hessian prisoners were held in the basement. We're going to see that actual basement. And we're going to go out to Trenton, and we're going to see where that battle took place. We're going to go out to Princeton and see where that famous cannonball, you've probably heard this story, or maybe you haven't heard this story, but Alexander Hamilton fires a cannonball that goes right through and hits the painting of King George. And we're going to see these things. You know, history is a fascinating and an exciting thing, and it's exciting to sit and read about it, but it's 10 times more exciting to actually go to the places where it happens and actually see the places where great historical actions happened. Washington crossing the Delaware was one of the biggest moments, bravest moments, that we have to look back on, and you're going to see it in an entirely new light after you go on that tour on that day. Now, after seeing that particular battlefield or those particular battlefields, we're going to see the Brandywine battle. We're going to see where George Washington fought and really failed to protect Philadelphia. We're then going to go to Valley Forge, another incredible place. You heard about it probably in school, and it really is a seminal place because this is where the army was born. This is where George Washington was able to get this rabble, as people called it, and turn it into an army. It's really the key moment of the war in a lot of ways, because General Howe is off in Philadelphia, and they're having parties, and they're going to dances, and they're having a great time. General Howe, of course, is having an affair with this lady, Mrs. Loring. He has no interest in going over and attacking George Washington, but George Washington uses that time to really train and teach his army to become an army with the help of Baron von Steuben, and we're going to hear all about him. We're going to see the actual house where George Washington stayed. George Washington stayed in this small house with Alexander Hamilton and Lafayette. And we're going to see that place. So fans of Hamilton, you're going to like this as well, because of course Hamilton plays a large role in this period of George Washington's life. Then we're going to see Monmouth. That's one of my favorite battles in terms of giving a tour, because so much happens in this battle. There's so much political content and there's so much military content here. It's one of those battles where everybody says they won at the end of it. You know, England says, well, we won because we were leaving Philadelphia and going to New Jersey, and that was our intent, and we were able to do it. The Americans say they won because they gave them a hard time and because they stood up to them. And in a lot of ways, that really is the truth of it. Now, they're going to turn it into a monumental victory, which it certainly wasn't. But I think after they had that battle at Monmouth, the British realized, you know what? We should have wrapped this thing up. We should have wrapped this thing up before they knew how to face enemy fire, before they were trained. Because after Monmouth, I think they know it's going to be a difficult, difficult war, especially since France has already stepped in. So that's kind of a key battle, and I love to share that with people. After that, we're going to step back a little bit. We're going to take a trip out to Northern Neck, Virginia, and we're going to see where George Washington was born. From there, we're going to go off to Mount Vernon, Virginia, and we're going to see where the young George Washington lived and the old George Washington lived. Finally, we're going to end up in Williamsburg, Virginia. And in Williamsburg, Virginia, we're going to see Yorktown. We're going to see Williamsburg, of course. So this is a place that had importance in young George Washington's life, but especially this key battle that's going to end the war and really propel George Washington into greater things. So in short, we're going to see where he was born, we're going to see where he died, we're going to see his grave, and we're going to see everything in between. And this is something, if either you're interested in George Washington or you want to instill an interest in American history with your kids, this is a way to really get to know these people in a manner that's fun and in a manner that's informative. It does that great thing. It combines travel and history, and there's no better 1-2 punch in the world than travel and history. It's the stuff that gives you the goosebumps, and that's what we're out here to try to do. So if you're interested in taking this trip with us, please give us a call at 610-642-2410 and check out our website at chasingamericanhistory.com. As I said, we're going to take a step away from the George Washington podcasts, and we're going to talk about the United States Constitution for a little bit. We'll probably go back and forth, but this constitutional series is going to be many episodes. It begins with the birth of the ideas that lead to the Constitution, and it's going to go on through the writing of the Constitution, and then it's going to go on through the beginning of the Constitution. So this is going to be a multi-layered approach. And what we're going to do is look at the people. I love biography. I love hearing about the people that were involved in history. That's what makes history exciting to me. That's why I think people love Hamilton. Yes, it's a brilliant musical. Yes, the songs are memorable and catchy. But what Manuel has done that's so brilliant is he's introduced us to these people. And there's a lot of people who have a problem with some of the ways that these people are presented. Certainly, he takes extreme liberties with Thomas Jefferson, shall we say. But I don't have a problem with that. You know, the way I look at it, the musical is interpreting Jefferson, the writer, in a lot of ways, who is a very kind of outlandish, cocky individual. But in any event, what it does that's so important is it introduces these people as people. And that's so very important to our youth. You know, the reason I quit being a lawyer and started doing this was I believed that we are losing our grasp on history. I don't believe that young people are being taught history. I think too many teachers, too many people feel that it's somehow parochial to talk about American history. No, no, no. Let's talk about world history. Well, of course we should learn about world history, but I think you have to begin learning about history by learning about your own history. You know, if we want to raise people to become citizens of this country, they need to know what this country is. They need to know what it's about. If we're going to raise people who are going to make intelligent choices in their votes and in other ways, you know, this is a republic. This is a democracy. This is a country that is dedicated to the proposition that its citizens can participate and can help. But education is the key to that. We're scared to teach American history now because there's difficult parts and there's parts that can make people feel uncomfortable. There's parts that might make people unhappy, might make people feel victimized, might make people feel guilt over ancestors' actions. You know, history is what it is. And every country has its good parts and its bad parts. And I think the only answer to this is to deal with it all honestly. In the George Washington tour that I talked about, we're going to talk about slavery. We're going to talk about George Washington's slaves. We're going to talk about his record and where it's good and where it's bad. And that's just the only way history should be taught. We can't turn these people into something they aren't. We have to talk about them as they truly were. But it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult thing to teach it, and it's difficult to teach it in today's political context. I think a lot of teachers are scared to talk honestly about history because they might offend somebody and then they might get in trouble. So the reason I do this is I want to share American history with people of all ages. I want to share American history with new immigrants. It's some of my most exciting moments giving these tours are when you have new immigrants who are coming to this country because they're so interested in our history and they want to learn the history so much more than most of our young people do. Of course, I've had a tremendous amount of young people who are interested in history. So I know it's not dead. I know that there are young people out there who are being given this thirst by their parents and who are interested. You know, one tour I gave quite a while ago, there was two parents and they had their young daughter who was about 12 years old. And she gave me this look I kind of can recognize of blasé disinterest. And she spent much of the tour on her cell phone. And at one point, the father came up to me and said, "Now, don't feel insulted. She's writing down everything you're saying." And I realized that that look of blasé disinterest was much like the look I would see on court stenographers during trial, almost stepping out of your body in order to write everything down. She was writing every word I was saying down and taking pictures, and she had written this incredible journal of the tour. What I'm dedicated to doing with Chasing American History and with Bowtie Tours is sharing our history. So if you want to come to Philadelphia, you want to come to some of these tours in Philadelphia, please do that. Check out Bowtie Tours and come out and join us. But if you want to go with one of our tours, we'd love you to do that as well. So again, call us at 610-642-2410 and check us out at chasingamericanhistory.com. Anyway, back to what the discussion of the day is going to be, the U.S. Constitution. We're living in a crazy time, but in a lot of ways, I'm very excited about what's happening currently because it's causing people to take a look again at the Constitution and at our history. Let me just talk about one thing that occurred over the summer that really made me kind of excited about the Constitution and about current events. As my listeners know, I'm sure, at the end of the presidential campaign, that's my dog, Chip. He's participating, for those of you who want to know. He's a poodle. He's got a very loud mouth. His sister is Buddy. She's a pit bull. Anybody interested in photographs, please feel free to contact me. I'm one of these people who's perhaps too willing to share photographs of my dogs. Anyway, back to what I was saying. So we all remember President Obama sets forward these sanctions, and the Russian response was zero. Konstantin Kesachayev, who is the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the upper house of the Russian parliament, said that this is agony not even of lame ducks, but of political corpses. That's my Russian accent, so I apologize to anybody from Russia out there. That's the best I could do. You know, they didn't respond because in the world of Putin, there was no need to respond. In the world of Putin, his guy got in and his guy was going to fix things. Maybe messages were given him to expect that. I don't know, but President-elect at that time, Trump, certainly put forward a message to let him know that he was probably on the right track because he said they had reacted exactly the right way. So this feeling was out there that the fix was in. Well, on July 30th, Putin sought to punish the United States for the sanctions. And I thought that was a great day. I thought we should all be celebrating, Republicans and Democrats. You know, this was a truly bipartisan moment, because the reason Putin did this was that the Senate, led by the Republicans, let's give credit where credit is due, created legislation which made it impossible to take away those sanctions. And what Putin learned on that day was that we really do have a constitution. Not something that you talk about and mention when it's useful and ignore when it isn't useful, as the Russian constitution has been used by him. We have a constitution that people really have to follow. Oldest constitution in the history of this world. Oldest operating constitution. And so I thought we should all have celebrated that day. It didn't get a lot of notice, but I thought, well, here we have the constitution at work. But that really isn't such an unusual thing. I was a criminal defense attorney for 23 years. I was a public defender for a number of those years. And so many days I spent in court making motions to suppress evidence. And here's the Constitution actually being enacted every day. Here are these words written by James Madison and his associates being enacted every day in all circumstances all around this country. And I don't know that those of us in the room doing that really feel any kind of emotional connection when we do it. You know, it's very kind of, you know, it's usually quite humdrum. I'll say, Your Honor, I have a motion on this case. The judge says, Counsel, what's your motion? What are your grounds? I say, Your Honor, this is a motion to suppress. This is a motion to suppress any and all evidence that was recovered from my client on the date in question under the grounds that the police had neither reasonable suspicion nor probable cause to search my client. And there we go. And I think we should stop every now and think about what a rare thing this is, that we are in this country that spends all this money to eradicate crime. We have these huge, terrible problems with crime. We hear about it all the time. We see it on the news all the time. And we spend all this money to combat crime, to arrest people who are committing crime. And then what do? Then we spend money to ensure that everybody arrested for these crimes receives their constitutional protections. That's not a normal thing. That goes against a lot of instinct. That goes against a lot of the core values of a lot of people. But we do that because those were the ideals instilled in us from this Constitution. We've done it ever since this Constitution was written. I don't know if we were writing a Constitution today that we'd be giving these kind of rights to people. Probably not. But we did give it to them then, and we still have this Constitution, and we still go through this process. And for those people who say, well, justice system is a sham, you have one for the poor and one for the rich, I would say, of course, having money helps you in every endeavor in life. But I'm probably the wrong person to say that to, because I've had too many clients walk out the back door, free men, when everybody around me wanted them going out the side door and going into prison. And these people didn't pay any money for my services. These people received my services because the Constitution of the United States assures them that right. They have a right to a free trial. And it was determined, well, a free trial isn't really a trial. It's not due process if you don't have a lawyer. So they all have a right to a lawyer. Anybody can follow their constitution when it's easy. The difficulty is following the Constitution when it isn't so easy, when it would be easier to do other things. And certainly there have been numerous times that we of a country have not followed our constitutional principles. In any event, let's get to the story of the beginning of the Constitution of the United States. Now, it's always hard to figure out what a beginning is, because a beginning, in a way, is a fictional creation by a writer or a teacher. It's almost impossible to say where something begins. And you have to pick a time, and you go from there. And the time I'm going to pick is 1761. And we're going to begin this story by talking about two significant deaths that had just occurred and the results that came from these two deaths. The first important death is going to be the death of King George II. And mainly that's because of the person who follows King George II, King George III, is going to play such a large role in the revolution of America and in subsequent events. And many of us in America think of him as this crazy individual. There are discussions of his madness, which he exhibited at times in his life. It was a medical condition, not dementia, and he would come and go from it, and he's going to get better. He's at the end of his life. He's not demented. He's doing quite well. But I think as we look at the mistakes he made during this period, I think it's a mistake to think they're attributable to his madness. They're the kind of mistakes I think anybody could make in his position. He's the head of an empire. Empires don't like to give up parts of their empire. That's kind of the first rule. And he's going to reach the point where he has just had it up to here with the Americans, and he's going to make a number of errors during this period. In later years, when John Adams is a very old man, the story is told that a child goes up to him and says, "Mr. Adams, my mother says that you did more than anybody else to bring about American independence." And John Adams says, "Oh, no, no, that's not true. The person who deserves that accolade is King George III." And certainly King George made a number of errors. And certainly he's going to become a large character in this story. So he's the first person who dies that's going to make a big impact. The second person who dies is the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, Chief Justice Stephen Sewell. And this is why this becomes so important. When Justice Sewell died, he was replaced by Thomas Hutchinson, a loyal British subject who's going to become a very large figure in upcoming events. His main importance in this particular story is not as to who he is, but who he is not. He is not James Otis Sr. Well, why does that matter? Well, it matters because James Otis Sr. believed that the position had been promised to him. And so did his son, the well-known, brilliant attorney, James Otis Jr. James Otis Jr., the man who was all ready and set to defend the hated writs of assistance that England was threatening to use against the colonies. These writs gave British constables carte blanche to serve without any kind of specifics or evidence to support the writ, a warrant. In other words, if you were on this list, the British could go into your house and search your house. And there was no way to find out why you were on this list. It's why I always get a little upset when everyone thinks it's okay to get blanket lists from the White House. Oh, he can't fly on a plane. He's on a list. Huh? I mean, isn't that how this whole thing started? We don't just accept lists from our presidents. Don't care if we like the guy. I don't care if we trust the guy. We need to know why the person's on the list, right? Well, that's what the colonists argued back in 1761, that these writs were unconstitutional. The writs only expired in one circumstance, and that was 6 months after the death of a king, at which point they could be restarted again. Ah, well, we just had the death of a king, did we not? Now, had James Otis Sr. been appointed as promised to the position of Chief Justice of Massachusetts, James Otis Jr. probably would have found himself arguing against those who challenged the writs. But that's not what happened. His father did not get that appointment. James Otis Jr., considered by many to be the most brilliant attorney of his time, resigned his position, walked across the street to the office where those opposed to the British practice congregated, and he offered up his services free of charge to challenge the writs. Now, in fairness, I should tell you that Otis's biographer denies that his hero was in any way influenced by the Crown's action of choosing Hutchinson instead of his father. It may be that the patriotic trend was intensified a little, he admits, but that either father or son was transferred from the king to the People's Party by the failure of Colonel Otis to be appointed Chief Justice is not to be believed. One person who certainly did believe it was Justice Hutchinson himself. He said this: both gentlemen had been friends to the government. From this time, they were at the head of every measure in opposition, not merely in those points which concerned the governor in his administration, but in such as concerned the authority of Parliament, the opposition to which first began in the colony and was moved and conducted by one of them both in assembly and the town of Boston. From so small a spark, a great fire seems to have been kindled. Only somebody so fully indoctrinated into the English perspective could truly believe that the entire revolution was about this personal slight. Still, a revolution is in many ways a very personal kind of thing. We're going to hear a lot of stories about the personal anguish, personal anger people have against Great Britain, the anger George Washington's going to feel when he doesn't receive the money he thinks he believes and feels that there's prejudice against him because he's an American colonel, doesn't receive the positions he thinks he deserves, the anger Benjamin Franklin will feel when he's taken to the British Parliament and gratuitously insulted. On and on, there's always the personal and the political, and sometimes it mixes. And so, the British no longer have James Otis to argue their case, but they're going to retain Jeremiah Gridley. Now, Jeremiah Gridley was an epic lawyer. He was Otis's teacher. He taught John Adams. I believe in the Adams Chronicles, he was played by John Houseman. He's that kind of character. Very well known, very well respected. And so it's going to be Jeremiah Gridley who's going to take on the Crown's side of things against James Otis for the Boston Merchants. Now, Gridley's speech was lawyerly and competent. It was full of precedent. It cited statues from the time of Queen Anne, the reign of Charles, William III. All of these statutes, Gridley is going to explain, permitted collections of revenue in the British plantations by officers who could search both public and private houses. Now, that's the phrase that really grated people, in the British plantations, because the colonies thought that they were partners. They thought that they had just fought a war together. And here we get out of Gridley's mouth, maybe for the first time, an enunciation of the way the British look at this relationship. They don't look at it that the Americans are a younger, tougher, stronger version of the British, that they're part of the British plantations. No, 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 no. They're the British plantations. They're little subcategories of British. So that's going to be a phrase that these Americans are going to listen to, and they definitely are going to remember. James Otis rises to defend the patriot cause. Now, there are speeches out there of which we only have distant reverberations, but speeches that people remember throughout their whole lives. I remember Jesse Jackson's speech in the 1984 Democratic Convention. I'd rather have Roosevelt in a wheelchair than Reagan on a horse. Thomas Jefferson used to talk about the speeches of Patrick Henry, and Jefferson was no fan of Patrick Henry's. Jefferson disagreed with him politically, he disagreed with him about a lot of things, but he always gave him his due as an orator. Patrick Henry, people called him the Demosthenes of the Revolution, and Thomas Jefferson used to say nobody would ever be able to read one of his speeches, because his speeches were so good, Jefferson said, that you wouldn't write them down because you were just too taken up by them as you listened to them. Well, we do have somebody who wrote down this speech of Gridley's, however, and that was John Adams. John Adams, a young lawyer just starting out, excited to come here and see the two great patrons of his profession arguing on behalf of this important issue that was going to turn into a cause that was going to turn into his life. John Adams would say this: Otis was a flame of fire, with a promptitude of classical allusions, a depth of research, a rapid summary of historical events and dates, a profusion of legal authorities, a prophetic glance of his eyes into futurity, and a rapid torrent of impetuous eloquence. He hurried away all before him. American independence was then and there born, the seeds of patriots and heroes to defend. The vigorous youth were then and there sown. Every man of an immense crowded audience appeared to me to go away, as I did, ready to take arms against writs of assistance. Then and there was the first scene of the first act of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there the child, independence, was born. In 15 years, that is, in 1776, he grew up to manhood and declared himself free. So what did Otis say to inspire this eloquent memory of Adams? Well, first, Otis is going to cheerfully plead guilty to the charge of abandoning his post, since that post required him to subjugate his fellow colonists. And he says, "This I will not do." Now, he began the substance of his argument not with precedent. There is no precedent. There's never precedent to revolutionaries. Instead, he's going to discuss natural rights of all citizens as discussed by Rousseau. Natural rights, in this case, against arbitrary authority and its abusive exercise. He argued that only special warrants, not general warrants, were legal, and that these special warrants were required to name the place and person and cause for suspicion. A general warrant, on the other hand, places the liberty of every man in the hands of every petty officer. This is what he said. "Now, one of the most essential branches of English liberty is the freedom of one's house. A man's house is his castle, and whilst he is quiet, he is as well guarded as a prince in his castle. This writ would totally annihilate this privilege. Custom house officers may enter our houses when they please. We are commanded to permit their entry. Their menial servants may enter. Bare suspicion without oath is sufficient." Now, this same argument regarding bare suspicion is at this very moment being made in thousands of courtrooms across this country. This very discussion is being had. But it was new then, when James Otis argued it in 1761. We had no legal precedent, but he did have a sense of his time, a sense that what may have been allowable at the time of Queen Anne or William III was not allowable now, at least not in America. And that may have been the most important part of the argument, because what came next could not be mistaken. He warned that the writs could never be enforced in Boston. He said that if the King of England should himself encamp with 20,000 soldiers in Boston Common, he could not enforce these writs. He even went on to say that the sugar tax violated the Charter of Massachusetts, and he said that the British king and the British Parliament and the British nation were all guilty of ingratitude and oppression in attempting to impose tyrannical enactment. Pretty major stuff. He's saying to this judge, he knows the judge is going to find against him. We all know that, those of you out there who are lawyers. I've been a lawyer, and there are cases when you know that guy up there is not going with you. But you know the next guy might, or you know something else might happen, and so you stand there and you make your argument, and you make your record. Usually those of us lawyers who are doing that are making our record for an appeal. James Otis is making his record for history. He's making his record for the country. He's making his record for the world. He's saying, Judge, you can find against us. I can't stop you from doing that. But we're going to ignore you. And he takes it a step further. We're going to oppose you. We will never let you enforce these writs. Now, we've heard in America people who have argued that there's a higher law to be followed. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, made that argument many times. But Martin Luther King Jr. never denied a court's jurisdiction. Martin Luther King Jr. always said, I will humbly allow you to arrest me. I will go to jail, but I am putting forth this argument for a higher law. That's not what James Otis says. He says, I'm following a higher law. And if you arrest me, I will shoot you. The judge ruled against Otis, as everybody knew he would. However, these so-called pernicious writs were never again issued in Boston. They may have found against Otis, but they took heed of Otis's warning. And if this was a battle, it was won by Otis and his side. And for everybody out there who believes that it's okay for the President of the United States to issue lists of people who can't go on an airplane or who can't do this or who can't do that, and for everybody who calls this reasonable, as people on both sides of the aisle have been doing, I would ask you to sit down and read James Otis's argument and try to remember the birth of our country. And remember something else as well. The founders were many things, but they were not reasonable. They were not reasonable when it came to protecting the rights of the citizens. As to John Adams's belief that this is where the revolution started, well, it's as good a place as any to choose. But what's also interesting is not only that Otis makes natural rights argument, and we're going to see that again, it is not only that he blatantly threatens armed resistance to what he calls British tyranny. What's important to us and to this discussion of the Constitution is that he proposes what is eventually going to become our Fourth Amendment. He puts out this idea that everybody's got a right. Now we call it a right to privacy. Nobody called it that then. But he says, if you're living in your house, nobody has a right to go into your house and search your house. These things are all being weakened in modern times. You know, I'm sitting here telling you this, and I'm doing it in front of my computer. And as a lawyer, I've had many clients who have had the government searching their computer. And judges don't seem to understand that that's a search. Are we allowed to be comfortable in our homes? Are we allowed to do as we please? Are we allowed to do this and know that we're not going to be searched unless somebody has reasonable suspicion and probable cause and a warrant signed by a magistrate? Or are we going to give this up as a bygone idea from simpler times? Well, that's for the future to decide. James Otis becomes the great unsung hero of both our revolution and our Constitution. Now, in later years, John Adams is going to do battle with those Virginians who believe that the revolution came solely from the efforts of their great leaders, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington. This is what Adams is going to say. The revolution was effectuated in the period from 1761 to 1775. I mean a complete revolution in the minds of the people, a change of the opinions and affections of the people, and a full confidence in the practicability of a union of the colonies. All this was done, and the principles all established, and the system matured before the year 1775. In other words, it was due to the efforts of James Otis and Adams's brilliant cousin, who we're going to talk about, Sam Adams, that brought about these initial events. And if Patrick Henry was indeed the Demosthenes and Richard Henry Lee the Cicero of the American Revolution, wrote Adams, then James Otis was Isaiah and Ezekiel united. Why then is he largely lost to the history books? It was not long after Otis's heroic battle against the writs of assistance that he was attacked by a British loyalist and struck on the head. Whether this was the cause of his oncoming dementia, we do not know, but he was affected at a relatively young age with the sickness. He also eventually backed off many of his early beliefs, seeking to save the union between the colonies and England. In Adams's mind, this was caused by the dementia. His death was dramatic. Standing in a doorway of a friend's house in 1783, he was struck by lightning. He reportedly once said to his sister, and this is Mercy Otis Warren, who became a very well-respected historian who would sometimes do battle with John Adams, who didn't believe she gave enough credit to John Adams and other Bostonians in her work. He said to her, "My dear sister, I hope when God Almighty in his righteous providence shall take me out of time into eternity that it will be by a flash of lightning." And that is exactly what happened. It is James Otis who first made the argument that would become enshrined in the Fourth Amendment, that no law enforcement official should be able to conduct a search without what we now call probable cause. But more importantly, it was he who first made the jump to argue the matter not purely as a matter of law or of the British Constitution, but as a matter of natural right. Whether England accepted the proposition or not, he argued that every American had a right to feel safe in his or her own home against any search by authorities. Now, with the time we have left, we're going to begin talking about another great hero of the birth of the country and of the oncoming Constitution, although, as you will hear down the line, in many ways he opposed the Constitution, but that is Sam Adams. Sam Adams, who we all know mainly by the label of his beer these days. The picture, by the way, on his beer bottle is not actually a picture of Sam Adams, just so you know. You might know him from the TV show Sons of Liberty as this kind of action hero. If so, I'm going to have to break it to you that that show, from the limited amount I saw of it, is a little bit fantastical. Sam Adams was not a handsome action hero, despite being portrayed as one in that television show, and despite the fact that if you see his statues in Boston, well, all statues make people look good. We have a statue of Robert Morris here in Philadelphia that makes this man also look like a strong, young, buff action hero, when in fact he looked a little bit more like Governor Christie. And yes, Sam Adams did work as a beer distributor, but he was a very unsuccessful one. He was in fact pretty unsuccessful at everything he did, except one thing, and that was serve the cause of independence as a strong and ardent propagandist. Now, Sam was born on September 16th, 1722, the son of a preacher. As a child, Sam marveled at the local preachers and the way in which they were able to transform the moods and sometimes even the thoughts of those who listened to them. When he entered Harvard in 1736 at the age of 14, he did so to study theology. He wanted to be like his father. He wanted to be a preacher. He loved watching how his father interacted with the other important gentlemen of his town, how people came to his father to discuss events. Sam's father, Deacon Adams, was a well-respected justice of the peace, a selectman and member of the colonial legislature, as well as a member of numerous political and trade clubs. People sought his advice because of his great skills as a political organizer. And at dinners, young Sam would sit and listen as his father spoke with other of the leading men of the community. Deacon Adams opposed any extension of crown privileges. He believed these came at the expense of their God-given rights, which had been laid out by the Massachusetts Charter in 1691. Now, just so we understand these charters, every single colony had its own charter with England. And in general, the Americans took these charters very seriously, the British much less so. This is part of how we end up with a different understanding of colonial rights. Because to the Americans, these charters are their constitutions. This is the only constitution they have. And what do they promise? Well, they say they can tax themselves. They say they can govern themselves, have things like their own Congress or House of Burgesses. To the British, These charters were simply an agreement made back in the 1600s, and they were consistent with the needs of that time. England didn't want to try to tax the American colonies in the beginning because the American colonies were 3,000 miles away and didn't have that many people and didn't produce anything. It would cost them more than it would get them. So this is where things start, because England's going to allow America so much freedom to govern itself. They think, well, it's easier this way. It's less of a hassle. Well, once you allow people certain freedoms, they are usually not going to willingly give them back. And so when you start to get issues of taxation, the Americans in general are shocked that the British think that they can tax the Americans, and the British are shocked that the Americans don't realize that they can tax them. Sam watched as his father fought any move by Great Britain to strengthen their power over the colonies. When the British ministry wanted to pay the governor directly from the crown to maintain his allegiance to London, Sam argued that this violated the Massachusetts Charter, which gave that power to Massachusetts. Now, Sam saw that his father wasn't only a believer in colonial rights, but a supporter of the common man against moneyed interests. And his father became caught up in a political battle over a land bank scheme that pitted the Whig Party, which represented the less affluent country folk, against the more wealthy Tory Party. Deacon Adams had attempted to form a bank in which members put up the value of their land in exchange for banknotes. Now, this is going to be very important. The issue of paper money. Can the colonies create paper money? Can they make their own money that isn't from the British crown? And it's also going to become very important in 1787 when we're making the Constitution of the United States, because one of the great problems that many people feel exist in the colonies at that time under the Articles of Confederation come from this paper money. So when we return, we're going to discuss with you Sam Adams, Sam Adams' father, Deacon Adams, the bank that Deacon Adams created, and how that bank and the English response to it helped bring about both the Revolution and the Constitution of the United States. So we will talk to you next week. So we'll talk to you next week in our second episode of The Constitution.